Go Bucks. Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm very thankful for this morning. I am so excited about Ohio State winning. You know, it probably difficult for some of the young people in the room to believe this, but there was a time as an Ohio State fan where we used to lose to Michigan. We used to lose often. When I was a child, our hopes and our dreams were dashed almost every single year by Michigan, who was always not quite as good as us, but always beat us somehow. And so I have this like deep-seated resentment inside of me, and I just like to watch this happen every year now. And so I'm excited about it. I'm flying high this morning. I'm fired up. And as much as I care about Ohio State football now, you know, there's a time in my life where it was probably the singular source of happiness or sadness in my life. Isn't that sad? That's very sad, but it's true. Every Saturday I watched a game, and then the whole week leading up to the next game, I would be like reading statistics and seeing like how does this do for us in the national championship picture? How's it doing in the Big Ten picture? I mean, I was like wild about it. And then Saturday would come, and if they won, it was like lather, rinse, repeat. Do it again. If they lost, then I was like storm clouds and anger and resentment, and my life was terrible. And my parents were worried about me. My parents were worried about me. And when I watched the games themselves, it was like quite a spectacle. There would be just wild swings of emotion. Like, I would be so happy, I was almost in tears, and then 5 minutes later, I would be screaming in frustration and anger. I used to have hypothetical, like sarcastic conversations with offensive linemen on Ohio State's team on the TV that missed the block, or with like our defensive coordinator that I didn't think was scheming properly. And my parents were just like, what's wrong with you? I had family members who would drive in from long distances to come watch the game, but mostly to watch me watch the game. And so it was like, I mean, it was a whole situation I had going on back in the day. And there was one game that I remember in particular. It was a Michigan game, and it was once Ohio State stopped losing to Michigan, so we ended up winning that game, but watching it, we had the lead at halftime. We gave it up in the third quarter going into the fourth quarter. And I was very upset about that. I was unhappy with their performance. And so I got up out of my seat to go cool off. And what happened in between the third and the fourth quarter has become a source of controversy in my family for years. Because accusations have been made and allegations have been leveled about what happened. But I've admitted to nothing. There were no eyewitnesses. There was no cameras. There's very little circumstantial evidence, and it would never hold up in court. And so just as I tell the story, remember that in between the third and fourth quarter, somebody went outside in a fit of rage and started throwing their mother's lawn furniture. These guys, the plastic chairs, you know, very garden variety lawn furniture. And the thing, you know, that I've heard secondhand about lawn furniture, if you throw it, is it's not very aerodynamic. So, like, you'll catch a little bit of wind resistance. But if it's a calm day, they're very light. And so you can chuck them a long distance. And if you're elevated on a porch, you can really throw them pretty far. And they're structurally, they're not meant to withstand that kind of impact. And especially, like, once they get exposed to the elements, like the extreme changes of temperature typical of an Ohio, you know, they're just fragile. And so whoever threw them, I'm sure, did not expect them to shatter upon contact with the legs falling off and the seats splitting in the middle. And whoever did it probably saw them and was like, oh, I'm going to be in trouble for this. And so they tried to put them back in the same place where they got them. Because, like, no one sits in lawn furniture in November, December, or January. So, you know, very mysterious. I don't know what happened. But Ohio State won, and all was right with the world. And my mom came inside on Sunday, and she said, what happened to my lawn furniture? And my dad was like, what do you mean? She's like, it looks like somebody broke all of my lawn furniture. And my dad had watched Ohio State football with me for years. Okay, I wasn't as young as you're hoping I was when this happened. So he knew what I was capable of. And she said this, and he was like, and he just started like staring into my soul like fathers do. And I was like, if I don't make eye contact, they can't see me. But that's not true. It's a myth. They can still see you even if you're not looking at it. And so I was just like, and my mom saw my dad look at me like this, and she was like, John, what did you do? And I was like, I think I heard some raccoons last night. Those are vicious creatures. I don't know what they get up to at night. They're nocturnal. Could have been them. She's like, stop. What did you do? What did you do to my lawn furniture? And so I had a decision to make. So I looked at my mom. I looked at my dad, and I took a deep breath, and I was like, look, we live out in the country. There's no fencing around the house. There's no security system. There's no apparatus. I find it irresponsible that you guys would set it up. Anybody could have come up here and started smashing your lawn furniture. So I don't know exactly what you're accusing me of, but I admit to nothing. And to this day, it's a mystery. No one knows what happened to that lawn furniture. There's investigations have been launched, and people have drawn conclusions that I frankly find unfounded and unfair. But no one knows what happened. If it was me who did it, which it wasn't, if it was, what would you call that kind of behavior? Going outside, getting angry, and breaking your mother's possessions because of Ohio State football. You might call it, like, social inappropriateness or mental instability, maybe. And that's fair, but I want to challenge you on something real quick. I'll call it something else. I'll call it enthusiasm. I was excited. That's all. I was just excited. One time I was watching Ohio State basketball game. I was displaying very similar behavior, and my mom and dad were in the kitchen, and my mom was like, what's wrong with him? Is he okay? Do we have to call somebody? And my dad was like, he's just fired up, Jill. He's just fired. I was like, that's right. No deep-seated issues here. I'm just fired up about sports. And perhaps this is an unhealthy, negative display of enthusiasm. Perhaps. But healthy enthusiasm, displayed properly and positively, is a really, really attractive quality that we have as people. Don't you like being around people who are enthusiastic when you are excited about something? Doesn't that make your life better? Enthusiasm is a really, really important part of our day-to-day life. And so today I get to talk about enthusiasm within your faith. Enthusiasm that you have for God, for your faith, for Jesus, for what you believe to be true about how saved you are and how that should manifest itself in your life and how that affects the people around you. And so I'm really excited to talk about that. I think this is a really cool subject that I get the privilege to talk about. Before we get into it, this word is interesting. The etymology of it actually comes from an old Greek word, entheos. And entheos has two words in it. Theos, which means God here, and then en, which means in. And so entheos means full of God, God within. And so it's kind of ironic that the etymology of the word enthusiasm, meaning full of God, we're talking about what it looks like to be enthusiastic about God today. It's pretty cool. Enthusiasm means being full of God. And so what I'm going to talk about today is I think that being full of God, being enthusiastic, looks like being fired up for God. It looks like being excited for God, excited about your faith. And I'm going to go through this in three steps. So there's three things that I want to touch on today that I think are really interesting. The first one is what I mentioned previously. Enthusiasm is attractive. Everybody wants to be around someone who's excited about something. Isn't that true? Don't you have examples in your life of people who made you excited about something because they were excited about it? And so we'll talk about that. That's not very controversial. The second one is that enthusiasm is commanded. And so this is a little more controversial. I think that we're actually called to be enthusiastic people. It's not like a nice to have. It's not a personality trait. I think we're called to be fired up for God. And then the last one is, if that's true, if we're called to be fired up for God, then I think it has to be cultivated. We have to do things in our lives to stoke the fire, to stoke the flame, to make it go, and to sow that enthusiasm within us so that we display it to the people around us. And so I'm going to go through these three things. The first one, that enthusiasm being attractive, like I said, everyone has a story about somebody in your life who made you excited because they were excited. Even that unhealthy display of enthusiasm that I was talking about earlier with me and Ohio State football, I'm going to be honest with you, people kept showing up to watch the game with me. I mean, my family kept showing up to watch the game with me, and they knew it was a 50-50 chance that plane was going down. I mean, they knew that that was really risky. That could end in a fiery crash or just like unmatched joy. It was one or the other. And the people who came were people who liked Ohio State football. They were fired up about it, and they liked that I was fired up about it. And so enthusiasm is attractive, and positive displays of enthusiasm, healthy enthusiasm, is one of the most magnetic qualities that we can have as people. 7 years ago, I came here to 514 Church. It was New Albany Church at the time, for the first time ever. And no offense, but do you think that I wanted to come to church? I didn't want to come to church. I was a baby Christian. I had never been a part of a church in my whole life. I thought that organized religion was bad. Like religion, okay, it's fine to worship God, but if you do it in an organized setting or in a corporate setting, now it's evil. I didn't know why I thought that, but I did. A lot of people think that. A lot of people don't know why they think that. I was one of them. And so I showed up. Jenna came home one day, my wife, and she led Young Life in New Albany. She said, this guy I lead Young Life with, he's starting a church. We're going to go be a part of that church. And I was like, I don't want to go to church. And she was like, I don't care. And so I started going to church. And when you feel like that, you don't show up like ready to receive the word. You don't show up like, I wonder what truth bombs the pastor is going to drop on me today. I'm excited about this. I wonder how my life is going to be shifted towards God. That's not the way you think. Really, I would show up like more concerned with what would happen that I could have a problem with. Like, what can he say or she say that might make me, that I can disagree with, that I can take issue with? So I'd come and I'd stand through worship. I decided I didn't want to participate in that. And then Joel would get on stage and I was like, okay, I wonder what he's going to say that I can have a problem with. I wonder what he's going to say I can get mad at. And an interesting thing happened. Joel would come up on stage, and if you know Joel, if you know him as a person, he is like the epitome of expressive enthusiasm. He's fired up about stuff all the time. It doesn't matter what it is, really. I mean, it could be like the iPhone 10. It could be Ohio State football. It could be his kids. It could be his family. It could be a sermon that he listened to or a song that he heard or a message that he's writing. He is like visibly fired up and he's ready to go. But when he starts to talk about the gospel, when he starts to talk about Jesus, when he starts to talk about a relationship with God, he glows. Like his soul catches, it ignites, and you see it start to burn, and light starts to come out. I mean, it's really, really amazing if you're around him enough to see this. And so I was in the audience ready to be critical, and I saw him on stage, and I was like, man, I kind of want to be a part of that, because enthusiasm's attractive. It's magnetic. Knowing how much effort and time and research and energy goes into writing a message, this is probably frustrating, but it was never what Joel said that hooked me. It was always the way that he said it. It was never the truth that he gave me. It was his passion on stage for this gospel message that got me. And I think that's kind of how it is. I think that's how it goes usually in our lives. It's how you feel. And, I mean, I was changed because of that. I never left. I'm at 514 Church to this day, and so I'm thankful for that type of enthusiasm. There's a preacher, a theologian, his name's John Wesley, back in the day, one of the most famous of all time, and people said, how do you gather the crowds that you gather on Sundays? He said, well, I just get up on stage every week and I light myself on fire because everybody wants to watch a man burn. And it's true, when you see that fire start in somebody, it's attractive. There's this story of a philosopher in the 1700s. His name was David Hume. And David Hume is one of the most famous philosophers of all time, very instrumental. He has this naturalist worldview, which is basically atheistic and anti-theistic. God cannot exist, and so here's what the world looks like since he doesn't. And David Hume was very instrumental in this way of thought, very atheist, very anti-theistic. One of his contemporaries at the time was a preacher, an evangelist named George Whitefield. And George Whitefield was a revivalist preacher, and so he'd drive around and he'd give sermons and he would gather crowds of thousands of people, and he was renowned for his ability to dramatically give his sermons, to dramatically reenact the gospel, the passion narrative, all that stuff. Like people would show up because he would get up on stage and he would go at it. I mean, he would pass out like 50% of the time in the middle of his message, like pass out. And then, like, wake back up and start where he left off. I mean, it was, like, bizarre stuff. The story is that David Hume and his friends were at lunch in London. And his friend said, hey, do you want to go to the pub later? He said, no, I can't. I'm going to a speaking engagement. They said, well, who are you going to go hear speak? He said, I'm going to go hear George Whitefield speak. And they said, the preacher man? I mean, aren't you, like, an atheist? Isn't that kind of your whole thing? I mean, what, are you a Christian now? He's like, no, I'm not a Christian. They're like, well, you believe the stuff he says? He's like, no, I don't believe any of that stuff. They said, then why do you want to go hear him speak? He said, because he believes it. Because he believes it. You believe that? No, but he does, and I want to go be a part of it. It's attractive when people are excited about something. All of the fastest growing churches in the United States were surveyed. All different denominations, all different communication styles, all different areas, all different demographics. The only thing that was consistent in the survey across every single growing church in the United States is that the people, not the pastor, not the staff, the people of the church were excited about what they were a part of. They were fired up about the mission that they were on, about what their church was doing in the community and who they were reaching. And that makes sense. That makes sense. That's attractive. People want to be around that. I mean, we're supposed to be lights, right? We're supposed to be lights to this world. 5:14 church, Matthew 5:14, you are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. But where nothing burns, there can be no light. So what is burning in you? What's burning in you right now? Is it God? Is it your faith? Is it something else? Is it nothing? We got to figure that out because it's important. Something will light you up. What is it? Because being full of God looks like being fired up for God. And because of the examples I just used, I think I need to hedge a little bit right here for a second. I'm using examples of people who are like expressive and outwardly enthusiastic in their disposition. But enthusiasm doesn't have to be that. Enthusiasm is not a personality trait. So whether you are expressive and gregarious like Joel or like George Whitfield that I talked about, or whether you are introverted and reserved and calm, more like me, it's going to look different. You're not going to all look the same, but people will notice your enthusiasm no matter how you express it. Being fired up for God's individual in its expression, but it's about passion. It's not about personality, okay? So it's what you spend your time on, what you spend your money on, what you get emotional about, what stirs your heart. That enthusiasm will show, people will notice, even if you're not outwardly, expressively, verbally enthusiastic and gregarious. There's a guy who goes to this church, his name's Tim Mazick, and he does this ministry called Kairos Ministry. It's a prison ministry. And Tim is quiet. Tim is kind of like quiet and shy. He's not the type of guy who walks into a room and his personality just automatically fills it up. He's more like me. But when you start to talk to him about this ministry, it's a prison ministry, they go in, they share the gospel with prisoners, he lights up, he gets emotional, he gets tears in his eyes, he tells stories. You can tell that he's passionate, you can tell that he's enthusiastic. It's not a personality trait. It isn't a disposition, okay? It's excitement. It's what lights you up, and people can tell what it is no matter how you personally express it. And so enthusiasm is attractive, right? That's not controversial. Everyone has their own stories of people who have fired them up about something because they were fired up. It's attractive. The second one, I mean, this is a little bit more, this is a little bit deeper. I think it's commanded. I think it's commanded by God. I think that we are commanded as Christians, as Jesus followers, because of what Jesus did on the cross, to be fired up about it, to be excited about it. And so what I want to talk about today is the fact that we're called to be enthusiastic about our faith. We're called to it. It's not a nice to have. Like I said, it's not a personality trait. It's not when you feel it. We are called to be enthusiastic. And I think it's interesting in Romans chapter 12, verses 9 through 12, Paul starts to talk about this. And if you know, the book of Romans is one of my favorite books of the Bible. It's written by the Apostle Paul. And Paul was one of the leaders of the early church. And he was tasked with taking this Jewish movement of a Jewish Messiah in Jewish circles and taking it to the non-Jews, to the Gentiles. And so Paul was tasked with this job of taking the good news of Jesus and the gospel and taking it to the non-Jews. And so he wrote this, one of his great works in this is the letter to the Roman church. I mean, this is the capital of Rome. This is not a Jewish neighborhood. This is the capital of the largest empire in the world. And so he writes this letter to Rome where he goes through the gospel, the fact that we're broken, we can't have a relationship with God. Then he says, and then the nation of Israel was called to be his people, and they couldn't follow his commands because we're all broken. And so God had to send a savior. And so God became flesh and blood in the person of Jesus, and he died on the cross, and that death pays the penalty for you and for me and for the Romans and for the Jews and for everybody who's ever lived, so that all of us can now enter into a relationship with God. And so he's telling them this good news. And at the very end here in Romans chapter 12, he starts to talk about, okay, now here's what it will look like if you believe that amazing truth about Jesus on the cross. This is what you will be marked by. This is what the traits that you will project because this happened. And so he starts to talk about it. And I think this is interesting because he mentions enthusiasm and he sandwiches it in between these other traits that we might be more likely to, off the top of our head, say, that's what a Christian should look like. And right in the middle of it is enthusiasm. So I want to read it to you guys. It's really cool. Love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in love. Honor one another above yourselves. And so this is all like, you know, love, sincere love, sacrificial love. If you ever read Matthew chapter 5 and 6, the Sermon on the Mount, this is like straight out of the mouth of Jesus. This is very, very typical of what the early church would say you should look like if you're a Christ follower. You should love each other. You should be sacrificial in that love. And then he says this about enthusiasm. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. And you're like, okay, that's a little bit weird. And then after that, he says, be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, and faithful in prayer. Joy, hope, patience, faithfulness. I mean, that's all like, yeah, okay, that kind of jives. That is what I would expect a Christian life to look like. And so at the top, you have love sincerely and love sacrificially. At the bottom, it says, be joyful, be hopeful, be patient, and be faithful. And it's like those things, that's kind of what I would expect a Christian to look like. So what's this part in the middle about zeal and fervor? Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. This is interesting because the word zeal in the original language, the word zeal means like the opposite of slothful, the opposite of lazy. And so what Paul is saying here is like, wake up. I mean, did you just read the 8, 9, 10 chapters I just wrote about what it means that Jesus died on the cross, that you were dead and now you're alive? Did you just hear me say that you were hopeless and now you're an agent of hope? Did you just hear me say that there was nothing you could do and so you were rescued, you were saved, you were declared right with God? Did you hear that? Then get up. Then get up and go. You got to go tell people this. You got to go change people. You got to go move people. You have to go bring this love, this truth, this hope to a world who needs it. You have to go transform. Let's go. Get up. Be zealous. Paul thinks that those of us who consider ourselves Christ followers should be like, we need people in our lives to take the reins and pull us back. Like, we need people in our life to take care of us, to be like, don't run through that wall. Don't go run through that wall yet, okay? Go rest. Go, you know, recover. Go sleep a little bit. Just calm down. Don't run through that wall yet. Is that how we feel? And Paul is urging them, be zealous. Be zealous. Go after it. There's stuff to do. There's no tomorrow to wait for. Be zealous. Be excited. Be enthusiastic about this. And then spiritual fervor is a word in the original language that means like bubbling or boiling. And so it's like this uncontrollable boil or bubble of excitement and enthusiasm about that truth of Jesus on the cross and what that means for you. That should just flow out of you at all times. It should overflow. You should be bubbling with it and boiling with it. And what Paul is saying is that being full of God looks like being fired up for God. And what he's saying is that it's every Christian's job to be fired up for God. It's every Christian's job to be fired up for God. It's your job to be zealous. It's your job to have spiritual fervor. It's something that we're commanded to be. It's not a nice to have. It's not a disposition. We're called to it. And Paul comes at this from two different ways, I think. The first way is the way that you and I know, and that's the fact that if you believe what happened on the cross, if you believe that that's true, then this should happen automatically. If you believe that you were dead and now you're alive, you should walk through the rest of your life just bubbling with enthusiasm about the fact that you're alive. If you thought you had no chance and then you got rescued despite yourself, we should walk through the rest of our life being thankful and enthusiastic and fired up, ready to share this gospel with anybody who wants to hear it. That's what Paul's saying. He says we're more than conquerors. We're more than conquerors. We won, and not just here, but we won for eternity. The scene has played out. And we know who won, and it's us. We won. And triumphant people are enthusiastic people. Are you kidding me? I mean, have you heard me talk about Ohio State football today? Because I don't play on the team. I didn't even go to the school. okay? But I'm triumphant this morning, and so I'm enthusiastic about it. I'm fired up. Paul's saying, you know you won. You know Jesus on the cross means that you won forever. That should automatically fire us up. That should spark and ignite this flame inside of us that shines light. But if you're like me, you hear that, and you're like, yeah, I know that that's true, and I know I should feel that way, but sometimes I don't. Sometimes it's not that easy. So, like, I get the fact that we're called to be this way. I get the fact that, you know, if I truly believed, I would be this way all the time. But sometimes it's not that easy. Sometimes I don't feel enthusiastic. Sometimes I don't feel fired up. I don't just wake up, roll out of bed, and start sprinting to go live this gospel life all the time. And I think that Paul knows that. Because if you think about the things that he sandwiched this in between, sincere and sacrificial love, patience in affliction, faithfulness in prayer, these things aren't easy either. In fact, they're just characteristics that describe this extremely demanding faith that we have called Christianity, called being Christ followers. So he knows that you're not always going to feel this way. It's not always going to be easy. God doesn't always just bubble out of you. And so I think what he's saying is that enthusiasm is an act of obedience. To be enthusiastic, it's an act of obedience. It's because you love God. You want to be enthusiastic about it. He's saying that it's not something that's always natural. It doesn't always come. It's not a disposition. It's a decision. Enthusiasm is a decision, not a disposition. We have to decide to be fired up for God even when we don't feel like it. And so I think what we have to do and what I'm most excited about to talk about today is this last part, which is enthusiasm is attractive, it's commanded, and if it's commanded and if it's a decision, then that means it has to be cultivated. That means that we have to cultivate it. We have to stoke the fire. We have to sow it within us so that it grows out of us. That's what we have to do. That's what we're called to do. If we're called to be enthusiastic, then we're called to cultivate our enthusiasm. And I'm excited about this because I think that this is actually not very difficult and not very demanding and not very time-consuming. I think this could take 5 to 10 minutes a day of you doing certain things, of me doing certain things, and feeling this enthusiasm, this excitement for my faith, for God, bubble up inside me so that the light comes out and people see it. I think it's 5 to 10 minutes a day, and I'm going to break this down into two categories. The first one, I'm going to call it relationship. You can cultivate your enthusiasm through your relationship with God. And what I mean by that is drawing near to him. Proximity. Get close. Do you always feel close to God? You don't. I don't. There will be times in your life where God, like, kicks the doors down to your heart and he overwhelms you and you can't do anything about it and he starts to pour out of you. There will be times in your life where that's true. But the rhythms of a mature Christian faith is that it doesn't always feel like that, and it probably usually doesn't feel like that. And so what you have to do in a relationship, just like any other relationship, is you have to draw near. What is your disposition like in moments where you feel far from God? How do you handle that? There's a book in the Bible called the Book of Psalms, and it's the prayer book of Israel. It's how they worship. And we love to talk about the psalms that are happy, the psalms that praise God, because they use very beautiful poetic language to talk about this beautiful God that we have. But what we don't often talk about is that 65 of the 150 psalms are called psalms of lament. And psalms of lament is the psalmist or the author yelling at God, God, where are you? Where are you? Do you love me anymore? I thought you were going to keep your promises. It doesn't really seem like it is now, so prove to me that you will. Where are you? Are you coming back? Why did you abandon me? Why'd you abandon me? Come back to me. Come back. Do you pray like that? I don't pray like that. The reason that those psalms are in that book to teach us how to worship is because in those moments, the poet felt far away from God, and so the poet pursued God. He pursued him. He went after God. He said, it doesn't feel like you're here, so I'm going to go after you. And so we have to do things in our life that you do in all of your relationships to keep you close. Okay? And in the realm of Christianity, it looks like this term that we'll call spiritual discipline. Okay? And that means like prayer, reading the Bible, reading a devotional, quiet time,
church, coming to church, being a part of a community with other people who worship the same God that you do, that should get you close to God. You see other people who believe that they were dead and broken, and then Jesus died on the cross, and now they're saved too. That should create excitement and closeness with God. And the reason I don't like calling this spiritual discipline is because these things, talking to him, learning about him, spending time with him, these are just very basic characteristics of what a relationship looks like. Isn't it? Isn't that just kind of what a relationship looks like? I mean, remember that we're not called to believe in God. We're called to have a relationship with him. We're called to have a relationship with him. And if you never talk to him, if you never read about him, if you never learn about him, if you never interact with him, if you never take time to figure out what he means in your life and how you fit into his plan, if you can't take any moments of your week or your day to give to him, do you have a relationship with him? Do you have a relationship with him? That's a scary question. It's a scary question. Because if you said that about a person, someone would call you crazy. Yeah, he's my best friend. I never talked to him. Haven't talked to him in 15 years. I can't take any time out of my week to message him on Facebook. I don't know what his family's like now. I don't know what he's going through. I don't know what he cares about, but he's my best friend. People would say, no, he's not. You don't even know him. No, he's not. And so we have to take these and look at them like these are relational moments where we get to draw near to God the same way that you do with your friends, the same way that you do with your spouse. Draw near to him. And this is important in terms of enthusiasm because you care about the things that you're close to, right? Take that same example of a friend. If you moved in together after college and then moved into the same cul-de-sac and you grew up through your 20s together, you were in each other's weddings, and then your friend had a baby, it's almost like you had a baby. It's almost like you had a baby, right? It's like, yeah, my life stops because my best friend just had a baby. I'm invested. I'm close. If the same friend you hadn't talked to in 15 years had a baby, you'd see it on Facebook and you'd be like, oh, cool. Neat. It doesn't change your week. It doesn't affect you because you're not close. You're not in it. You're not invested. Proximity does this. Relationship does this. It's like if I watch 162 Cleveland Indians baseball games, I really, really care about what happens in the playoffs. If I don't watch any games and then I tune in for the playoffs and they lose, I'm like, oh, bummer. Doesn't really affect me. I'm not close. I'm not invested. We have to get close to God. And when you get close, you'll start to feel the fire in you being stoked. You'll start to feel the enthusiasm starting to grow naturally because God is in your life and you're in his and you're with each other. And I think that change happens quickly. You'll feel it 5 to 10 minutes a day. And so enthusiasm is cultivated by relationship. And then this one is a little bit more general, but I'm kind of excited about this one. It's kind of my first ideas of trying to figure out what this means. Recognition. Recognition is this idea that all of us walk around a beautiful world and have beautiful lives and are beautiful people and interact with beautiful people. This world is good and is broken, but it's good. Sometimes we take it too far as Christians because we know just how broken it is and we say it's bad and it's wicked and it's evil, but it's not true. It's not true. It never has been, and it never will be. The world is good, and while it's not what it should be, it's beautiful, and it was created by a beautiful God who's present in the beauty that you see around you. And it could be physical beauty, like nature. I went to Cinque Terre in Italy a few weeks ago, and I stood on like a green mountain that overlooked a cliff that went into the bluest ocean I've ever seen in my life, and I was like, I mean, this is amazing. This is like, I mean, God is beautiful. His creative power is unbelievable. And when you recognize that in the world, you worship God. When you take these beautiful moments, and it doesn't have to be physical beauty, it could be relationship, right? It could be love. It could be passion. It could be friendship. Moments where things are going bad and all of a sudden something happens and it changes your whole day and it's good. In those moments, in that beauty, when you look at it and you reflect it back to God, that is a form of worship. And so we have to figure out what is it in our life that makes us feel that way? What do we already recognize as God's beauty in this world? And then we have to go put ourselves in those positions. What stirs your affections for Jesus? Where do you go in your day-to-day life? What do you do in your day-to-day life that just the beauty of it, the just how wonderful it is makes you stirred for God. It makes you look at him and praise him and worship him and just think, God, you are so good. It could be something simple. It could be like coffee. I mean, like sometimes I wake up in the morning and I'm like, I don't want to get out of bed. I don't know if there's a God. And then I drink coffee and I'm like, oh, yeah, there's a God and he's good. And he's a beautiful God. It could be something simple like that. It could be something grand like nature. It could be something practical like you and your spouse getting a babysitter and reconnecting over dinner in that moment, in that beauty, in that interaction. If you see that, if you feel that, and you throw it back to God, you are worshiping God. And you will start to grow enthusiastic about him when you start to recognize the beauty in your life and in your world. It's almost like thankfulness, what Joel was talking about. Tom Baker said he's thankful for his kids. When he recognizes God in that, he's worshiping God. It's beautiful. And all of a sudden, the enthusiasm in you, the excitement about your faith, the excitement about who God is and what he did for you starts to bubble up. It's the flame starts to get stoked and light starts to come out. And it's really beautiful. I think that this is honestly 5 to 10 minutes a day for you to do this. C.S. Lewis puts it like this. He says, these things in your life that are beautiful that you see, they're not the things to be worshipped, but they are the things that point to your God. He said, they are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. They're pointers to God. They reflect him. They reflect his beauty and his love, and he's given these things to us to enjoy and to worship him in. And when we recognize them, we start to get really, really excited about how good he is and how much he loves us. And so my challenge this week is that we take 5 minutes a day. Take 5 minutes a day to pray or to read or to reflect in quiet time and be with God in relationship. Grow close to him. Bridge the gap. Bring proximity. Do what you would do with a friend. Talk to him. Learn about him. Be with him. 5 minutes a day. I mean, just set your alarm 5 minutes earlier. And then drink coffee. It works. And then the second thing is I want you to think, what already in your life stirs your affections for God? What do you do on a daily basis? If it's your kids, that's a great example. What do you do on a daily basis that you see it, you experience it, and you're like, wow, God is great? And focus on those things. And if you don't have things in your life that are like that, then think about what could be. What are you missing? In what moments in your life are you missing the recognition of God and how beautiful he is and what he's given you? And take moments throughout your day to recognize that. And then put yourself in those situations. I know that sounds simple, but it's like if nature makes you feel God's presence, then go walk into the woods. Go walk into the woods and be in nature. There's nothing more important than that. If reconnecting with your spouse makes you feel how great God is, then hire the babysitter. Go do it. Go do it, and what you'll find is the excitement that starts to be stoked within you can't be contained anymore, and people will start to notice, and those attractive qualities will start to come out of you, and people will want to be around you and know what it is that you're hopeful about, what it is that you show so much love about, what it is that you feel so fired up and passionate about in whatever way you personally display it. And so I'm going to pray for us, guys. I want you to take these and honestly, Just try. And see how it feels after a week. And see if your excitement for God starts to grow. I'll pray for us real quick, and then we can get out of here. God, thank you for today. Thank you for this church. Thank you for what you've given us and the ability to gather together and to worship you and to just be here in community. I just pray that we can spend time with you this week. That we can get to know you better, that we can just take a little bit of time out of our day to be in relationship with you, and that we can notice the things in this world that fire us up for you, the things that make us know you're there and know that you're good. And I just pray that you can give us the capacity to recognize that and to worship you in those things, Lord. Thank you for everything you've done for us. Thank you for who you are. In your name we pray. Amen. Before you guys go, as you leave, we've got these everyone's invited invitation cards. Grab a handful of these, hand them out to people, and let's get a bunch of people in this church who have never been here over the next few weeks, all right? Thank you, guys.